Well, good morning. So those of you who received my text know what I'm going to be speaking on today. And I'm still on this In Search of Certainty series. And so today I'll be talking about the certainty of God's love as an expression through His sovereign rule. So I think it's true, don't you, that many of us tend to measure God's love for us according to how He answers our prayers and our requests of Him. That's one of the criteria. Does God really love me? And if He does, is He going to answer my prayers the way I want my prayers to be answered? It's interesting because I've had some conversation with a few people of late for whom this really applies. They have some things going on in their life that are difficult and painful. And so if you think I'm talking about you specifically, I am not. I'm talking about this as a general principle, and that one of the things that the world needs to know is the certainty of God's love. It just so happens that in my conversations with you, it brought home to me the importance of this particular thought and practice. So with that in mind then, I want to put some of this in perspective. So prayer and praying to God is very important. And God wants us very much to pray to Him and to bring to Him all those things that concern us. Because on some level, if things concern us, then they concern Him. If things concern us, they concern Him. That doesn't mean that we get everything we want in our concerns, but it still means that it is of importance to Him as He guides us through those things that concern us. Now think about it. If God gave us everything that we prayed for and wanted, if everybody got everything they prayed for and wanted, what kind of a world do you think we would live in? It'd be pretty chaotic, don't you think? So, in like manner, for example, just how loving would it be to our children if we answered every request they made of us, regardless of how passionate and sincere they were? How many times have your children, with the utmost of sincerity and with a great deal of energy and passion, begged you for a particular thing? Or grandchildren, how many times have they begged us because they had to have it? It was so important, they would die unless they got that thing, right? Life would end for them unless they were able to get that particular thing. And so that's not just one thing. How many times over the course of their life and your life have your children, and then when they didn't get it, they pouted, they were angry, they were resentful, they couldn't believe that you wouldn't do that for them. It's so easy. Why can't I have this? Why can't you do this? Those kinds of things. So imagine 7.8 billion people praying to God and saying, please, I'm going to die without this. I have to have it. So if we leave it up to ourselves to ask God for everything that we want, and 7.8 billion people are getting answered, that would be pretty cataclysmic.
Well, it was in that movie. What? Where God answers the email. Jim Carrey.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It goes
chaos. Yeah, that's exactly right. So what that means then is there has to be a perfect, overarching, centralized plan that we all have to comport ourselves to in order to have order health. All of those kinds of things that are necessary. And all of that within a world that is deeply fallen and broken and depraved. And all of that within a world where God gives humanity tremendous autonomy, self-rule. We get to make our own choices. So who would want to be in charge of that? Would you? Can you imagine, like Jim Carrey, having to be responsible for all of that? So it's important then to understand that when God is sovereign, when God acts providentially, that it's because it is the best thing for us, even though it doesn't look that way, no matter how painful that might be. And it's because that we live in this world that is broken and damaged and corrupt and depraved. Let me ask you this question. How many of you want God to just take you over and make you do what he thinks you should do? Really? Because if God forces us to do what he wants us to do, then is that really a loving relationship? If you forced your children to love you, is that a loving relationship? If you forced your spouse, I mean, you don't want to use extrinsic means to make somebody love you. You want somebody to love you on their own because they see the value of who you are. Is that not true? So it's a complex system. There isn't anything that 7.8 billion people can do that will challenge the sovereignty of God in his ultimate plan for humanity. I mean, think about how powerful you have to be that 7.8 billion people can do anything they want and your plan will still come to pass. Doesn't challenge you in the least. So coming back then to his sovereignty and his sovereign plan for our lives and our world, the only way to make it through this world the best way possible is for us to figure out what is God's plan, his overarching plan for our lives, and to submit to that and to live according to it. And when bad things happen, as they inevitably do, and I don't say this lightly because I've had some bad things happen to me and I've had to fight through it over the course of my life, I understand. I can empathize. I certainly haven't been through some of the kinds of things that some people here have been through. But I will tell you there are some people in this room right now who will say that because they've surrendered their life to Christ, regardless of what their health is or whatever, that is what made the difference for them. Am I right? So I'm looking at my dear, dear friend here, Sherry Lubick, and that's been your message to me in so many ways, Sherry, how you've surrendered your life. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Are the words of Job. Isn't that true? So the Lord gives to us what we need, and he will not allow us to endure any more than what we can endure. But he will test us. He will test us. And those tests are there many times because not only is because it's the kind of world that we live in, but those tests are there because that's what we need. I can tell you that over the course of my father's life, all of the hardship that he endured economically, relationally, all of the hardship that he endured physically, the multiple heart attacks, the multiple strokes, the diabetes, it was the last heart attack that brought him to faith in Christ. It was God's sledgehammer to get his attention. And I wonder if my father is complaining about that now. Because he's in heaven. and he would trade all that, right? Wouldn't trade all that if it meant not getting into heaven, not being with Christ, not living in eternity. Look, there are a lot of biblical examples of unanswered prayer. There's Abraham and his barren wife Sarah. There's Moses' 40 years in the wilderness with Israel with all their bickering and complaining and whining. I'm sure he prayed about that some. There's David when he pleads for the life of his firstborn son. You recall that Bathsheba was pregnant and his firstborn son was born ill. And he pled and he begged for God to spare the life of his firstborn son. And as a part of his punishment, God took David's firstborn son. Then there's the time that Jesus prays in the Garden of Gethsemane. If there's any way, Father, that you can take this cup from me, I pray that you would. But then he says, not my will, but yours be done. What if God had answered that first part of the prayer? Where would you and I be today? Sometimes we have the audacity to complain about our own suffering, and many of us here have suffered horribly, while forgetting at the same time the horrible suffering that Jesus Christ went through on our behalf. Jesus knows a little bit about suffering. So it's not like we don't have a Son of God who is sympathetic to our circumstances in this world. And many of you remember Paul's discussion about his thorn in the flesh, where God appoints to him a thorn in the flesh to keep him humble. And he begged God for, I think, 7 times, please take this, 3 times, please take this away from me. And God said, no, in your weakness, my strength is made manifest. So, you know, and I was talking with the elders yesterday, and you ever think about this? You ever think what it might be like for Adam and Eve to be in heaven, to look back over the course of time in this world, and to see the unmitigated pain and suffering and horror that their rebellion caused over the lives of 70 or 80 billion people, that if only they had remained faithful, none of us would have ever had to go through this or be in danger of that. I just wonder if maybe it's God's grace that they can't see back over the course of time. What a horrible thing to be able to see. I don't know. But did you ever think about this? Are we ever really in touch with how much our sin has caused pain and misery in the lives of other people? Things that we said, things that we did, that caused, that initiated, that encouraged people to do things that they would not have normally done. And then they pass it on to others. And it lives generationally. I mean, everybody here said at one point, when I get to be an adult and have kids, I will never do to my kids what my dad did. We've all said that. But here we are. We've passed some of it on. And then that's just what we did. What about what we didn't do? You know how Paul says to Timothy, love covers a multitude of sins? When we choose not to love, we choose not to cover sins. It's God's grace that you and I cannot see the fullness of our rebellion and disobedience and sin, and how it's impacted all of the people throughout the course of our life. It's God's grace we can't see that. We are the reason why some prayers are not answered. We are the reason why some people say prayers. But it's God's grace. And it's His ability to cover all of that that makes a difference in our lives. It's His plan. His sovereign plan can account for all of that. God's overreaching sovereign plan for mankind is loving, gracious, and merciful. Our passions and desires and prayers have to be subordinate to that. That's the next slide. God's overarching sovereign plan for mankind is loving, gracious, and merciful. Our passions and desires and prayers must be subordinate to it. Because your plan and my plan and our plans are insufficient to compensate for the sin and the brokenness and the depravity in the world in which we live. And so, whatever happens, we give it all to Christ. Whatever happens, we allow Him to use it, to manifest it, to make it bigger and better and stronger, to redeem it in some way that we could never redeem ourselves. So I'm going to spend some time then in John 11, verses 17 through 43. If you have your Bibles, turn to that, John 11, verses 17 through 43. It'll be up on the screen too. This is a complex story. It's a little lengthy, and so I'm going to work my way through it to help illustrate some of the things that I am talking about this morning. About God's, the certainty of God's love as it is established through His sovereign will in the lives of humanity. So when we begin to read here, we have to understand that it begins with that there is a life-threatening illness. Lazarus has suddenly taken very ill. And despite Mary and Martha's best efforts, it appears as if he is about to die. Lazarus has a very special relationship with Jesus, as does Mary and Martha. Mary is the one who, earlier in the text, entered into the house and anointed Jesus' feet with nard and began to weep and wipe his feet dry with her long hair. And she did that because she lived the life of a prostitute. And she came to terms with that prostitution, and she sought His forgiveness, and she experienced His grace, and she was so thankful that she wanted to demonstrate in some dramatic fashion what Jesus had done for her. This is that Mary. So apparently she's reconciled with Lazarus and Martha, and she's now living at home with them. And so they all have this very intimate, very special relationship, more so than what Jesus has maybe with some other people. So the text reads, "Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped His feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill." Now, during this time, then, there is a special request for help. Out of desperation, they send for Jesus, who was within a day's journey outside of Judea and just on the other side of the Jordan River. So he was not far. He was within a day's walk where he could come to their house and, as he had done so many times before, heal someone who was sick. And in particular, somebody that he loved very much, who was sick and in danger of dying. So the sisters sent to him saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." So he gives a hint about why this illness is there. Despite that, there is the appearance to heartlessly ignore a plea for help. And so we read in verse 5, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus." The word is agape. So it's the most powerful word for love that there is. Sacrificial, unconditional, noble kind of love. Verse 6, "So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was." So imagine you sending a desperate request for help. And you know that the person is not far, that they could be there relatively soon. And instead of getting in their car or walking right over, they stay. And not just linger, they stay much longer. And it looks as if it's just heartless. How could you not answer this request? You say that you love them. We know that we love you. Why would you not be here? Why would you not come? Can you imagine Mary and Martha being in that house? And if they had a watch looking at it, or their phone looking at it every you know, couple of minutes, they know he's just virtually around the block. He doesn't show up after a few hours. He doesn't show up after the evening. He doesn't show up the next morning. He doesn't show up in mid-afternoon. He doesn't show up that evening. He doesn't show up the next morning. Where is Jesus? Remember Jesus, the one, these people whom love you and you love them? Where are you? We've all asked that question of God at times, have we not? Where are you? I have this need. I'm desperate. This is very painful. Come and help me. Where are you? David asked the same question many times in the Psalms. In one psalm, he says, "Answer me! Where are you?" Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were there, just now seeking to stone you. Are you going there again?" So he'd had an altercation with the Jews earlier, and so they left because of that altercation, and now he's going to go back. So we come to the point in the story now where there is a tragic death of a loved one. Despite Jesus having been alerted, he does not leave immediately. In fact, he waits 2 additional days so that by the time Jesus leaves to go to Mary and Martha, 4 days have passed. Verse 11. Jesus said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, so I will go awaken him." This is pretty typical of Jesus, where oftentimes he would speak cryptically. The disciple said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." And so then Jesus offers this hint and a cryptic statement regarding his overall plan. Verse 13. Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him." So Jesus reveals that there's something going on in the death of Lazarus, and that for their sake, he was glad that he did not heal Lazarus, because something bigger was going to happen that they needed to see and experience, that they could not see, that they could not begin to grasp. Because what was going to happen in the life of Lazarus was going to speak for the next 2,000 years. And it was going to give people a preview of what was happening, what was going to happen with Jesus. And that was the purpose. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us go, that we may die with him." So They missed the point entirely. Now, there was another particular reason why Jesus waited 4 days. This time period is crucial because, according to rabbinical tradition, according to what the rabbis would teach through their teachings, the Mishnah, for example, they believe that the soul hovers by the grave for 3 days in the hope of the reunion with the body, but at the first sign of decomposition, it departs finally. This is meaningful because Jesus, who said that this sickness will not end in death, but that it's for God's glory, in short, Jesus waited for the 4 days to make sure that no one who knew the rabbinical tradition could say that after he raised Lazarus, that it wasn't really Jesus who raised Lazarus. It was the soul, they would say, that was hovering around the grave, and that soul simply re-entered the body. Jesus had nothing to do with it. After 3 days, 4 days, the body clearly decomposes. It breaks from the rabbinical tradition, so there's no other explanation other than Lazarus had been raised from the dead by Jesus, not by the soul returning to the body. Does this make sense to all of you? Verse 17. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off. So Jesus begins to go to make his way there, and we see that there is real and poignant grief and mourning. The sisters mourn because they sit beside the grave of lost hopes, the lost hope of a brother who could protect them. If you were a woman in Palestine and you had no male to protect you, that was a dangerous thing. That's why many women resorted to prostitution, because they had no other way to provide for themselves if they did not have a brother or a husband to protect them. No kinsman redeemer, for example. The grave of lost hopes also had to do with the fact that they were hoping that Jesus would come and heal Lazarus before he died. Their hope was lost because he died, because there was no Jesus. So Lazarus is their brother, whom they obviously love very deeply. And so as they sat beside and wept beside the grave of lost hopes, wondering what was going to happen to their lives, why Jesus wasn't there for them. Verse 19, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So that was a part of that whole community coming together in mourning. And no doubt Jesus had been a part. I mean, I would imagine that if you are close to Jesus, that you're name dropping to a certain degree, right? Well, yeah, Lazarus is sick. He's really sick, but don't worry. Jesus really loves him. He'll be by. He'll get healed. He'll be okay. We're confident of this. No Jesus. Lazarus dies. Mary and Martha are devastated. The rest of the community are like, what happened to Jesus? I mean, he healed other people. He healed people he didn't even know. He healed Gentiles. He healed people who were sinners. Lazarus is a good man, of high repute within our community. Why wouldn't he come here? I'm sure that was part of the conversation. So then there is an aggressive and passive-aggressive response against Jesus by both sisters. Verse 19, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Verse 20, so when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out and met him. She confronted him. She was frustrated. She was angry. But Mary remained seated in the house. I'm not going to go see him. I'm going to sit here and pout. I'm going to be angry. I'm not going to give him the satisfaction. There is an indignant confrontation and accusation. Verse 21, Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." There's nothing like stating the obvious. Is that not true, huh? We all love it when people state the obvious to us, don't we? Like, right? So, and that's what was happening here. Martha made it very clear. If you'd been here, he would not have died. You did not come, therefore you meant for Lazarus to die. Why would you do that? Why would you embarrass us? Do you know how many people we told about you? Do you know how many people we've tried to get to follow you because of how much you love us and how much you've done and how much we've supported you? I'm sure that was all part of the conversation. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But see, God has broad shoulders. He doesn't get defensive like you and I do when people state the obvious. So with Martha, there is still her confession of faith and hope, even in the midst of darkness and despair. Verse 22, she says, "But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." I mean, that's quite a statement of faith, don't you think? It's 4 days after. All the empirical evidence would suggest that Lazarus was beyond restoration. So she had a strong faith, but she was still irritated with Jesus. And sometimes it's okay to be irritated with God. I mean, when King David, the man after God's own heart, says to God, "Answer me! Why won't you answer my prayer? Why won't you do what I ask? Answer me!" Sometimes it's during those dark moments of real honesty that we arrive in a place in our heart that it's the best place for us to be. Sometimes it's during the darkest moments when we have the least amount of, I don't want to say hope, but recourse, but still obey, that it reveals the rootedness, the solidity of our faith. So in the Screwtape Letters, for example, there's this encounter where Screwtape says to Wormwood, "Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in jeopardy than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our God's will, looks round upon a universe in which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and asks why he has been forsaken, and still obeys." That's kind of where Martha was. Does this make sense to you here? So Screwtape is saying, as one of the demons of hell, when a person feels utterly forsaken and abandoned and still obeys, that's a person of faith. That's a solid soldier of Jesus Christ. There is a response that Jesus' sovereign purpose is behind his, what, I'm sorry, there is a response that Jesus' sovereign purpose is behind his action and his plan. So Jesus, in verse 23, Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Again, she's stating this confession of faith. Verse 25, Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live." Take the life and death of Lazarus away. Have Jesus say that same thing and ask yourself the question if it still means the same thing. Remove Lazarus from the text. And then just read that. Does this read the same way then? It does not. This is one of the iconic passages in the New Testament. This is what many of us hang our entire faith on. That Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And that because we believe in Him, even though we die, yet shall we live. Jesus leverages the death of Lazarus to utter this incredibly powerful statement. A statement of hope. So there's this principle that grief and pain and suffering is often designed to cause a return to the foundational core of one's belief and confession of faith. Grief and pain and suffering have a way of eliminating the chaff in our life that covers, the trash that covers the essence of our faith that we need to be reminded of. It takes us back to the basics. It forces us to rethink what it is that we really believe, who it is that we really trust. Verse 26, "And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" Jesus says. She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." You are the Christ. You are the Savior. You are the Messiah. Again, there's this confession of faith that's orthodox, that's true, that's very powerful, that applies to this principle that repentance and confession of faith brings restoration of faith. Restoration of faith leads to the restoration of others. Because what happens here? After Martha's faith is restored, after she in essence repents and confesses her faith, and it is restored, what does she do? Verse 28. When she had said this, she went and she called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and he is calling for you." Mary, who refused to go see Jesus, who's back at the house. Martha, whose faith is restored in this conversation with Jesus, goes back to Mary, says, "The master is calling for you." And what is Mary's response? She rose quickly and went to him. Verse 31, when the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Verse 32, now when Mary came to Jesus, and so came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." She came to Jesus to confront and to confess to him her love and her concern for her brother. She went back into the presence of Jesus. Her faith began to be restored because Martha's faith was restored, because Martha had to come to terms with the core, with the foundation of what it was that she really believed about Jesus. And the confession that she uttered is as orthodox as you could ever have. And then there's this. Our sincere emotional travail and suffering moves the heart of God. Verse 32. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you'd been there, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly trembled. I believe in the Latin, if not the Greek, that word is splachizoma. And what it means is that your guts are wrenched. You feel so strongly, so emotionally, so powerfully about the situation that your guts are turned over. That's how Jesus felt about Mary and Martha's travail and their emotions, their sense of loss, their pain and their suffering. He loved them so much that his guts, his stomach was turned over with emotion. Verse 34, and he said, "Where have you laid him?" Then they said to him, "Lord, come and see." And then the shortest verse in all of the Bible, Jesus wept. Verse 35, the Son of God, the God of the universe, wept because of their pain, their sorrow, their travail. Jesus wept also because the sovereignly ordained suffering and death of Lazarus was providentially necessary in order to lovingly demonstrate Jesus' power over life and death. He wept because he had to take the life of Lazarus to demonstrate to people a type of resurrection that would be due to him. In other words, Lazarus demonstrated that Jesus had power over death and life, so that when Jesus would die later, not too much into the future, it would be easier for people to believe that Jesus rose again because he resurrected Lazarus. That was the point. That's why Lazarus' life and death was so important. It was to get people to begin to think that this man named Jesus had power over life and death and could resurrect people even 4 days after they had died. Jesus wept because those with whom he had a special and loving relationship felt abandoned and betrayed by him in the hour of their darkest need. They did not understand the overarching purpose, and so they felt betrayed and they felt abandoned. But this overarching purpose, the sovereign plan, was bigger. It was more important than them being consoled in terms of their betrayal and sense of loss initially. There was a bigger lesson. There was a bigger plan. Jesus wept because the suffering and death and resurrection of Lazarus was a precursor and reminder of his own suffering and death. Jesus wept because, just like Lazarus, suffering and death and resurrection would still not be enough to convince many in the world to believe he was the Son of God who came to save them from their sins. It still wouldn't be enough. He wept because he knew they wouldn't get the message through Lazarus and they wouldn't get the message through him. Jesus wept because many could still not see the bigger picture of why Lazarus' death was necessary. That God's sovereign plan was not only absolute, but also lovingly necessary for mankind. That God's sovereign plan to include Lazarus to die and to be resurrected, people missed the importance of that. They could not see the overarching plan with that. And we cannot see the overarching plan a lot of times with so many other things that God does. But it's still a part of his love for us that we can only see, oftentimes not in this world, but in the world to come. And that is our hope, and that is what we look forward to seeing and hearing when we leave this world and go into the next. Verse 36, so Jesus said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" So you had these two different kinds of people, right? Jesus loved Lazarus. Look, he raised him from the dead. And then you had these other people who would have believed that blindness was impossible to have been healed from because it was a curse from God. So to say he healed somebody who was blind would have been to counter a curse of God, and yet at the same time saying, but why couldn't he raise this guy from the dead? You can't please some people. So there is a command to be faithfully and obediently involved, even when it is difficult and uncomfortable. Verse 38. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, but this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days." So, you know, Martha returns to, like, well, you know, back to practical Martha, right? Like, you would think that if he could be raised from the dead, you shouldn't have to worry about the odor of the body. I mean, think this through, Martha, just a little bit, right? So in that command, Jesus is involving Martha and her followers to be obedient. I have a plan. I want you to take the stone away. But there's an odor. Just take the stone away. There is a patient reminder to obey and to see the glory of God at work in the lives of people. Verse 40, Jesus said to her, Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this on the account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! And the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, Unbind him and let him go. I would imagine there were tables being turned over and people were freaking out. This was just an unbelievable thing. And it sent a message to anybody who heard this. This man has power over life and death itself. Question. Given the supreme purpose of Lazarus's death, do you think if Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, now knowing what they know and had to do it all over again, that they would? If you had an answer for why you had to suffer, and you could see that it was attached to a plan that was much bigger, that it involved maybe hundreds, if not thousands, of lives in a redemptive fashion, would you go through that suffering again? I think Lazarus would. And I think that that was the subject of much conversation in their lives, that Lazarus felt privileged enough that God would take his life, that Mary and Martha would suffer the pain and sorrow of the loss, and yet see Lazarus raised from the dead to serve this much greater purpose, to help people believe that when Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried, that when he raised himself again, that they could believe it because of what they saw happen in the life of Lazarus. Now, you would think that that would be enough, but there is an epilogue to this story, just very quickly. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So instead of celebrating like, hey, this guy has it together, we could live forever. The only thing they could think about was how the Romans were going to come and take all their stuff. Verse 49, but one of them, Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year, said to them, You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. And not only the nation only, but also to gather into the children of God, into one, the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned to put him to death. There are some people who just can't get it. And there are some people for whom getting it is just kind of hard. And what they need are the Lazaruses in their lives to help convey a more powerful message that is a part of an overarching plan. So let me say this. Whatever you're going through, work hard to submit that to God's sovereign plan and purpose for your life. To submit to it. Knowing that God can use that in your life in ways you could never begin to fathom or understand or see. But you will on the other side. And understand this. on some level. Everyone in this room is required to be a Lazarus on some level. That we are to give of our lives in order that God be glorified and His greater purpose come to pass. That what happens in your life as a Lazarus speaks in ways that people desperately need to hear and would not hear were you not a Lazarus.